Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Dinosaurs are the topic of tonight's Science Unwrapped lecture series at Utah State University. Dr. Kenneth Carpenter, Associate Vice Chancellor at Utah State University Eastern and Director of the Prehistoric Museum in Price, is the guest speaker. He first got interested in paleontology in 1956, when his mother took him to see the film Godzilla.
I was so awed by this huge beast stomping across the screen. Today, I'm sure there have been children that have been influenced by the Jurassic Park movies, and some of them are actually about now coming to age where they're thinking about paleontology as a career. So Hollywood can have an influence on what a child grows up to be. Some people want to grow up to be lawyers, and which become Tyrannosaurus food. Some people want to be doctors. I wanted to be a paleontologist. And just never outgrew that passion.
Films like Godzilla and Jurassic Park pique our curiosity and inspire us to learn about the deep prehistoric past. But they don't always get the facts straight. Carpenter's colleague, Jack Horner, is the scientific advisor for the Jurassic Park film series.
He's fairly knowledgeable. We've disagreed on a few things. He admits there are some things in the movies that he's not too happy with, that they kind of played a little loose with the facts, but it's okay. It's not science, it is entertainment. It's just kind of neat to see those big dinosaurs up on the screen in a very lifelike appearance, or at least as lifelike as we understand them to be today. I mean, certainly what we think about Tyrannosaurus Rex has changed from first Jurassic Park and to the subsequent ones, as well as, say, the raptors, for example. Now we would probably put feathers on them because of discoveries of related dinosaurs in China that have been found preserved in lake beds with feather impressions around them. So I think if they ever do another Jurassic Park, we can expect to see some fuzzy-looking dinosaurs.
Godzilla continued to inspire Carpenter into his paleontological career.
I actually wrote a kind of a tongue-in-cheek paper doing an analysis of Godzilla from a paleontologist's point of view, as if Godzilla was a real dinosaur and trying to understand its anatomy and whatnot. And I actually did figure out how it's hypothetically possible to breathe fire. We know that a lot of animals create methane, and if it was to breathe out this methane, we know that there are some insects called the bombardier beetle, which spray out a two-part spray that combines and creates an incredible high burst of heat, which it uses as defense. The temperature can be up to 500 degrees, which is more than enough to ignite methane. So I hypothesized that Godzilla could, in fact, breathe out some methane and then ignite it, just like a bombardier beetle. Who knows? It was kind of fun, tongue-in-cheek. The big plates on the back of Godzilla are kind of modeled after Stegosaurus in a way, but there is actually some carnivorous dinosaurs that do seem to have some bone embedded along their back, which I argued could be the ancestral form which evolved into the big plates of Godzilla. As to its size, it's interesting in that the original Godzilla back in the 50s portrayed it as having really fat legs and was relatively a slow mover. And when you're about 400 feet long, which is kind of what I estimated Godzilla to be from the movie, then it was anatomically more correct, based on what we know about scaling, than, say, the Godzilla that came out a few years ago with the mutant iguana that attacks New York City.
Godzilla had a big influence in his life and eventually led Carpenter to international recognition. He is well known for his research into early Cretaceous dinosaurs, armored dinosaurs, and dinosaur reproduction. He has published 11 books, including Tyrannosaurus Rex, The Tyrant King, with paleontologist Peter Larson. The short forelimbs of T-Rex have presented a problem for paleontologists.
T-Rex is kind of an interesting animal. At one time, it was thought to be extremely rare. And beginning about in the early 1990s, people began to go out and actively look for them, and it turned out that they weren't as rare as was once thought. They're nowhere as common as, say, the plant-eating dinosaurs like Triceratops or Edmontosaurus. But nevertheless, we have found quite a few skeletons, and in fact, there's parts of a T-Rex have been found just west of Price, about 50 miles. So T-Rex was also a Utah native. The arms have always been problematic. People point out the fact that they're rather short. Well, that's true compared to the size of the animal, but if you compare it to the size of a human arm, it's actually about the same length. And people have assumed that because it's rather proportionally small, then that this was a rather useless appendage, but that's not necessarily so. When we look at the bone structure itself, it's a very heavily massive bone. It's very thick-walled. And the muscle scars on it are humongous. It tells us then that it was a very powerful arm. And we did some work on trying to estimate the size of the T-Rex arm muscles and how strong it could be. And the muscles were, I mean, the arm could probably have held close to half of a ton out from the body. So it's a fairly strong arm. Now, why was it small, and why did it only have two big claws on its hand? Well, if the mouth is the killing part of the animal, then if it's grabbing onto a prey with its mouth, it can use its short arms to essentially give it a bear hug, as it were, keeping the prey close to its body while it's biting down trying to kill it. You got to remember that the prey is going to be struggling and trying to get away. It's not going to just be passive and just let itself be killed. So having that short arm then is going to keep that prey close to the body so the T-Rex could then kill it with its huge banana-shaped teeth. The teeth are rather interesting in T-Rex also. Most carnivorous dinosaurs have rather long, slender, blade-like teeth. Those of Tyrannosaurus are more like a banana, and in fact you could call it a giant reptile with a mouthful of killer bananas. They're very long, they're very broad, and they're very powerful, and it indicates that it could easily chomp through bone. When I was in Colorado at the Denver Museum, I described a specimen we had there of a duck-billed dinosaur that had a big chunk taken out of its tail, and it had survived the attack. There's regrowth of bone around the injury. But the pattern of the injury matched just perfectly with the spacing and the shape and size of an adult T-Rex tooth. So we do know then that T-Rex could, in fact, be an active predator, despite the fact that there have been some people have said, well, it's so big and so slow and its arms are so small that it had to have been a scavenger. Well, we got scientific evidence that proves beyond question of doubt that T-Rex could be and did actively hunt.
I wrongly guessed that was his favorite dinosaur.
My favorite dinosaurs are the big, ugly ones, the ankylosaurs, because nobody loves them. They're very homely-looking, probably with a face that only a mother could love. They're rather crunchy on the outside and soft and chewy on the inside, I suspect, because they've got all that armor on the outside. Whether a carnivore like Tyrannosaurus could get through all that armor is something we don't really know. We'd need a time machine. But I suspect that if one of the ankylosaurs were to die from natural causes or some other reason, that if it could be flipped over on its belly, then it might give a Tyrannosaurus something pleasant to nibble on.
Determining the purpose and advantage of armor on Ankylosaurus and the related dinosaur Stegosaurus is an interesting area of current research, says Carpenter.
At one time, it was just thought of as just being for protection against large predators. But now there's some indications that there that some of this armor may have had other uses, such as, at least in the stegosaurs, with the big plates on their back, may have served species recognition. Certainly, you don't want to mate with the wrong species of stegosaurus because it's got a wrong kind of plate. They wouldn't allow it in this state and probably only allow it in California. But I think that other purposes might have been for controlling body temperature. Certainly, we know from studies done with alligators that they can, in fact, use the armor that's on their back to control body temperature somewhat. I mean, it's not as perfect as, say, the elephant's ears, which are really large. And an elephant gets too hot, it can flap its ears and cool itself off. We don't think that stegosaurs could flap their armor. But on the other hand, since you've got such a large surface area, it's certainly going to be a place where a lot of excess body heat could be radiated away from the body.
And they were huge, with big and bulky bodies, likely weighing 1 ton to 5 tons.
And so they were not very active. They were four-legged. They have very small teeth for the size of their heads. They weren't good at chewing. Certainly, if you compare them to a cow, they were far, far less efficient in processing the plant material that they were eating. From what we can tell, they were exclusively plant eaters, although it had been suggested back in the 1920s that that there was one form that was thought to maybe have been an anteater, using its long tongue to slurp up ants. The problem with that whole idea is that when you're this particular ankylosaur that this model was based on probably weighed close to 5 tons, and I am very doubtful that a 5-ton animal could sustain itself on just a diet of ants. There's nothing about the claws on its feet that would indicate that it had the capacity of ripping apart anthills. So from what we can tell on tooth wear, diet was almost exclusively just plants.
Dinosaurs got around. Carpenter says they occurred on all continents, including Antarctica and the Pacific Islands.
Such as New Zealand, it's got its share of dinosaurs. Japan has some on the north side. They were very cosmopolitan. They got around. If the continents were or islands were even remotely close enough that they could swim from one place to another, I'm sure they did. We do know that there are some similarities between some of the dinosaurs of Europe and Africa with those in North America during the Jurassic period, which would be, say, about 150 million years ago. So up until that time, the dinosaurs could easily have walked back and forth across, that was before the North Atlantic had split the continents apart.
One of the most common groups of dinosaurs found are the duck-billed dinosaurs.
They come in all shapes and sizes. They've been found mostly in the northern hemisphere. There's only a few specimens that have been found in the southern hemisphere, oddly enough. They're extremely common in the United States and Canada, some in Mexico, and they seem to decrease in abundance as you go farther south for some reason. They're moderately common in Europe, and they're fairly abundant in China. In fact, some of the biggest ones are known from China, and this is an animal called Shuntungosaurus that was probably 50 feet long, which makes it bigger than T-Rex. So I sort of doubt that T-Rex or its relative at that time would have done much with an adult Shuntungosaurus. Juveniles is another matter. They're going to be soft and chewy and don't have any defense. They don't have armor. They don't have horns. It's fair game.
In your opinion or research, what indicates the fiercest dinosaur, the fiercest predator?
Fiercest predator. Ooh, that's a good question. I have no idea. In order to know that, we'd have to have a time machine and go back and then do our comparisons then. We'd have to develop some kind of standard as what we consider ferocious. Does it mean that as soon as it sees me, it's going to go chasing after me, chomp me up, or does it look down, ignore me because it doesn't recognize what I look like as being food? There's all kinds of unknowns here, so it's really not an easy question to answer. I think a lot of kids, though, have their own ideas, and I've seen some arguments on the internet about who is the biggest and most ferocious dinosaur, and if, for example, Giganotosaurus from Argentina were to confront a T-Rex, who would win? I've seen arguments about that. I've seen arguments about whether Spinosaurus from Jurassic Park fighting T-Rex, who would win? And in the movie, Spinosaurus does, but in real life, who knows?
All of the mystery is certainly part of our fascination with them. Reproductive behavior is another area of research with many unknowns and a lot of curiosity. Progress in this research is contributing to major strides in our understanding of dinosaur biology.
The big question everybody always has is, how did dinosaurs do it? We don't know whether T-Rex had rough sex like lions, where they were biting each other, or whether it was passive, so passive that people are, you know, if David Attenborough went back with the time machine to film dinosaurs or T-Rex mating, whether he would just sit there and saying, well, do something already. We just don't know. There is some indication, at least some scientists have argued, that possibly T-Rex had kind of rough sex, because there are several specimens that have been identified as females, and I'll come back to how we know the sex here in a second, where there are bite marks all over the face. There's some, but whether that's due to rough sex or whether it has to do with territorial squabbles, we just don't really know. Now, the big question people have is, well, how do you know what's a boy and what's a girl? Well, if it was alive, you could look under its tail. But since they're not, what we have to do is that there are some other ways of telling. I had hypothesized way back in the 1990s that the T-Rex individuals that have a rather heavy bone, they're kind of heavily built, must have been the female. And my line of reasoning was that if these dinosaurs are pulling the calcium to form the shell out of their bones, then the female needed to have a large calcium reserve. Otherwise, what's going to happen? She'll have osteoporosis. And when you're Tyrannosaurus rex with osteoporosis, you're going to die. So what happened about, a decade ago, is there was a discovery up in Montana, and there was this woman, Mary Schweitzer, who was analyzing some T-Rex bone under a microscope, and she discovered, of all things, a special type of tissue inside the bone that only appears in birds today, female birds today, when they are laying eggs. This is called medullary bone. And it only happens during the time when they're egg laying. So here she had this specimen that clearly has this medullary bone. So it was an egg-laying individual, which tells us it's a female. Well, when you look at the rest of the skeleton, sure enough, as I had predicted, it was indeed the robust form. So we do now have a way of figuring out the sexes of dinosaurs. There's been some further work, and that type of medullary bone has been found in other dinosaurs, and again, it always appears in the more robust, heavily built individuals. So we're slowly beginning to get a glimpse into the world of dinosaur biology that when I was a kid was unheard of. And, you know, people used to write books on dinosaurs back then and say, oh, we'll never know the sex. Well, looks like we now can tell. And with the discovery of dinosaurs with feathers in China, we're beginning to see some differences as well. And so eventually I think we're going to even be able to determine color patterns and separate boys from girls from their feathers and the color patterns. So we're actually living in a really exciting time for dinosaur paleontology.
And are you able to determine how many offspring that they have over their lifespan, or
Well, we do know that dinosaurs laid eggs, and we do know that they did it in, well, it, some of them seem to have laid their eggs much like turtles and crocodiles, where they would form the eggs, hold them in the mother's body, and then lay them all at once, because we find essentially eggs in piles. And these eggs, for the most part, tend to be round, anywhere from the size of a navel orange up to the size of a small cantaloupe. other dinosaurs that have more of an avian or bird-like reproductive system appear to have formed eggs in two oviducts and would lay them in pairs. Now, modern birds have reduced one oviduct, so they only have one, they're only laying one egg at a time. And for a bird like the ostrich, it only lays like one egg a day. So laying a full clutch can take up to 2 to 3 weeks. As to T-Rex eggs, we've not yet found them, but we do have found other carnivorous dinosaur eggs, and we know that because we find the embryos inside. And these eggs do have a structure that's more bird-like than crocodile-like. And there have also been a specimen found in China in these lake beds in which there were two eggs preserved in the abdomen, or in the pelvic area, actually. So it looked like it had been a female that was in the process of laying eggs and for whatever reason got out into this lake and drowned, which is kind of cool to know this kind of stuff.
Dr. Carpenter will be talking about the science of dinosaurs at tonight's Science Unwrapped lecture series at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center at Utah State University.
You watch television, you see BBC is Walking with Dinosaurs, there's a storyline, although it's kind of a weak storyline because all you ever see the dinosaurs doing is either eating or fighting, that's about it, or laying eggs. But there's a lot about the world of dinosaurs and about dinosaurs in general that we've come to understand, but kind of the science of it is not presented very well or done at all, and people are rightly skeptical. And so my talk is to kind of give people an idea of how we know what we know about dinosaurs and have them understand that it's not all fiction, that Hollywood might take and fictionalize it, but there is some real science behind it. And my audience is primarily students that are in high school or perhaps freshmen in college who are struggling with sciences and don't quite see the need for it, even though they kind of like dinosaurs and they want to be a paleontologist. I mean, I will freely admit that when I was a student, I did not understand the relevance of, say, physics. And not until I became a professional and got interested in understanding how T-Rex arms work did I realize that I had to learn physics all over, because there's a lot there in biophysics and in biomechanics of in joints and levers and whatnot that I need. And so I want to try to address to those students that if you really want to do dinosaur paleontology, these are the different sciences and this is the math that you really should learn, and this is how it is applied.
You can catch Dr. Kenneth Carpenter's talk about dinosaurs tonight at 7 at the Eccles Science Learning Center at USU. Thanks for listening. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Bonnie Plants, plant growers since 1918, dedicated to sharing the love of gardening. To help people become successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners, information is at bonnieplants.com. Also provided by the Utah Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City, the epic story of Jean Valjean's struggle for redemption unfolds in the beloved musical Les Miserables, playing through October. Tickets are at bard.org.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the United Order of Orderville, the utopian experiment that thrived for a decade in southern Utah. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
When people hear the term communal living, what often comes to mind is a group of hippies, not a group of 19th century Mormons. However, the United Order movement, begun in 1874 by LDS Church President Brigham Young, was an attempt at economic and moral reform that was deeply rooted in utopian community ideals. Years after settling in Utah, Young and other church leaders became concerned that commercial goods and moral influences brought by the railroad were undermining Mormon communal values. they became interested in reinstating Joseph Smith's law of consecration, which in the 1830s had called for donating possessions to the church for the larger benefit of its members. Inspired by Smith's early cooperative experiments, Young created the United Order of Enoch and organized church members into communal settlements. One of the most successful communities to follow the United Order was appropriately named Orderville. Located in Kane County, east of Zion Canyon, Orderville was established on July 14, 1875, as an offshoot of the Mount Carmel United Order. Orderville community members had an unusually strict interpretation of communal living. They ate together in a common dining hall, wore uniform clothing that was locally made, and lived in identical housing. An elected board supervised all social and economic activity, and residents were assigned to work in departments such as blacksmithing, midwifery, or farming. There was no private property, since all belongings were deeded to the order. At the end of the year, accounts were balanced, and those who had excess donated it back to the order, while all debts were canceled. The community thrived, but took a major blow when polygamy was declared a felony in 1882. This forced the largely polygamous leadership of Orderville into hiding, which weakened the town. By 1885, Orderville abandoned strict communalism, but with over a decade of success, it was Utah's longest-running experiment with the United Order. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Michelle Hill. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions on Access Utah. I'm Sherry Quinn. On today's show, we explore the pharmaceutical industry in Utah. It started around 20 years ago, and Dr. Ted Stanley was among one of the first to start a pharmaceutical company in the state. He invented the famous fentanyl lollipop for pain relief in the 1990s and dealt with just about every pharmaceutical company in the nation.
It's inappropriate that the public is being made to believe that drug companies are evil, they're bad, they just rip you off.
The pharmaceutical business is a game of risk where few can play. Utah is holding its own and set to grow. Coming up, we hear from local industry leaders and learn where one Utah scientist searches for new drug discoveries in faraway coastlines. Dinesh Patel was among the first in Utah to start a successful pharmaceutical company in the mid-1980s called Theratech. They developed the estrogen and testosterone patch. Now he is director of V-Spring Capital, a venture fund investing in high-tech and pharmaceutical startup companies. They are managing roughly $400 million and have invested in over 60 companies. Patel explains how supplements can contribute to the pharmaceutical industry, but notes there are crucial differences.
It's not like there is no connection. I mean, a lot of pharmaceutical companies will send out their folks to go to, say, South America or go to India or China, look at herbs that have been used as medicine there, and then try and isolate the active ingredient. So that part of the business still continues. The natural supplement part, obviously these products cannot make a medical claim, and so they're easy to get on the market. And at the same time, because it's easy to get on the market, you could have a lot of products that really don't work. And so that's where a company that has good science behind their natural supplements, they could do well. And, of course, we have a very, very large industry in Utah in that sector.
Has it had an impact on the pharmaceutical industry in the sense of economics? Or
having a nice or a really good natural product, has it taken away sales from a pharmaceutical product? I don't think so, because in reality, both of them are growing. So you don't see cannibalization of one market. Mm-hmm. If that was happening, then what would happen is the natural product market would be growing and the pharma business would be going down. And that's not the case. I mean, they're both growing at a healthy clip. So a lot of the times you think of pharmaceuticals to be used when you're sick, and you think of natural products to prevent you from getting sick. So in a way, they're complementary markets.
Dr. Ted Stanley likes to cross-country ski when he's not working on founding a new company or a new drug. He is an anesthesiologist with a good sense of humor who has worked at the University of Utah for more than 40 years. He has also been a research professor of surgery since 1978 and has published hundreds of manuscripts and contributed to dozens of books. In the past couple of decades, Dr. Stanley has become a successful entrepreneur. He has founded or co-founded several life science companies, which include pharmaceuticals. He is well known for inventing the fentanyl lollipop drug used for rapid pain relief in children and adults.
It's called Actic, and I'm kind of proud of that one. It's been very, very successful, and not only for patients with cancer, but patients for other kinds of pain. And there are doctors that use it for a variety of different pains because it's so easy to titrate. That means give to effect. That is, patient can use it just to what they need. And since everybody's different, this is a wonderful aspect of it because they can, using the stick to pull it out of their mouth when they're done, can take just what they need and not any more, which is a very useful thing. And that's one of the reasons why it's popular. And then it was very safe and very fast, because the drug went through the linings of the mouth, which is called the mucosa, and it was the fastest way of giving a pain drug. The only thing that faster would be to give it intravenously. So that pain, that speed of pain relief when you're having really bad pain is a wonderful thing.
Before we go further, it's important to understand the FDA regulations. Here's producer Susie Montgomery.
When approving a new drug, the FDA asks two questions. Is it safe and is it effective? No drug is absolutely safe. There's always a risk of an adverse reaction. In order for approval, benefits must outweigh risks. Before the drug is evaluated for approval, it must go through a series of clinical studies to determine its safety and efficacy. The FDA's role in development of a new drug begins after successful animal testing, at which point the manufacturer is ready to test human subjects. So the drug's sponsor or manufacturer then submits the investigational new drug, IND for short. It's an application that contains the research information and relevant data. The Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is a regulation that mandates labeling must be truthful and that the drug is safe and effective. These FDA guidelines are some of the strictest in the world.
Getting a drug to market is a long, arduous trek with many hurdles. It can take anywhere from 5 to 12 years to reach the marketplace. Dr. Stanley says he has dealt with pretty much every pharmaceutical company in the industry with his fentanyl lollipop, which inspired him to start his own company in the mid-1980s. Today, he still wears many hats. He is also a partner of Upstart Ventures, a seed venture fund investing in and trying to develop new life science technologies in the Intermountain West. He knows all the angles to the tough pharmaceutical market.
For the average drug in the United States today, it costs close to $1 billion to get it approved. Now, for an anesthesiologist and a pain person, some of the drugs are less expensive because they're not used on a daily basis for years and years. They may be used once or only a few times. So the studies are not as long and not as expensive. Or else you take older drugs and you are using them in novel, different ways than they have been used in the past. So then the studies are not as demanding. So those are generally cheaper and shorter ways to get through the approval process. But sometimes they are also quite expensive. I've been involved in studies, even with these well-known drugs that have been around for years, that one study cost $10 million. One study in one group of patients.
Despite the odds, the industry in Utah is persevering.
the pharmaceutical industry in Utah didn't exist 20 years ago. But slowly, there is a growing number of small and even somewhat larger, a very successful pharmaceutical company called Myriad Genetics, which is probably the biggest pharmaceutical company today that is headquartered and was founded here in Salt Lake City. One of my partners, Denny Farrar, was one of the founders of Myriad Genetics. He and the current CEO founded the company in the early 1990s, as I recall. But now there are many smaller companies that have been founded and grown. Some of them have been purchased by larger companies from outside of Utah, like the company that I started called Anesta was purchased in the year 2000 by a larger company called Cephalon. Cephalon still has an important presence here in Salt Lake City. It manufactures many, maybe all of its drugs here in the Salt Lake Valley. And there are other smaller companies that are being born almost every day now. And my hope is that there'll be enough of them that are successful that these little twigs will become bigger trees and eventually giant, very successful companies that are having an influence not only throughout the United States but throughout the world with the drugs that they're developing and producing.
Dr. Stanley explains why Utah is the place.
Well, Utah is a very entrepreneurial place. And this is particularly true with the University of Utah, but it probably holds true with some of the other research universities like BYU and Utah State. But it's particularly true at the University of Utah. As a matter of fact, the University of Utah has become known in the last 3 to 4 years as a university that is spinning out more new companies, many of them pharmaceutical companies or drug delivery companies, than any other university in the country, with the exception of MIT.
Which has 3 or 4 times the amount of research funding as the university does.
That is Tom Parks, Vice President for Research at the University of Utah.
So we are very, very good at turning research dollars into technologies, into commercialized, licensable technology. We may be the best in the country at that.
The reason I came here is actually because I was at Washington University in St. Louis, and I was finishing up my MD-PhD and my clinical stuff, and I became very aware of the work of Mario Capecchi and the work of Ray White, and I decided that this is the place.
Dr. Dean Lee is a physician and professor of medicine and human genetics at the University of Utah Molecular Medicine Program.
I came here in the sort of mid-90s, and what I had made the decision was that there were going to be two very important technologies to make advances in medicine and drug discovery, and two of those advances were in the fields of human genetics and then the field of what we would call developmental genetics, the ability to change genes in animals and study their effects. And I thought the combination of human genetics, which tries to define genes that are important for human disease, and developmental genetics, which then allows you to alter those same human genetic genes in animals to study what's going on, was a perfect combination to understand disease and potentially define new medicine. So for me, it was the perfect storm.
One of the projects Dr. Lee is working on is figuring out what blood vessels in the body do in response to inflammation.
So one of the things that inflammation does to blood vessels is to cause the blood vessels to leak fluid. And that fluid, if it's in the lungs, causes you to have problems with how much you breathe. If, for example, you have blood vessels that leak in your eye, it makes you go blind. If you have blood vessels leak in your brain, you get brain swelling. If your blood vessels leak in your sort of joints, you get arthritis. So the central thing that we're working on is, can we understand how the blood vessels react to the inflammation? And most importantly, how can we prevent inflammation from stimulating blood vessels from leaking? And if you understood that, then what you could do is you could make and design medicines that would prevent the blood vessels from leaking when it sees inflammation. So essentially not reduce the inflammation, but reduce the blood vessels' response to your inflammatory system, and thereby reducing sort of tissue swelling. The classic description of inflammation anywhere in your body is that something is red, it's hot, it's swollen, it's painful. That central sort of feature of inflammation is in so many diseases, and we are understanding the mechanisms by which that occurs. And we think that there may be strategies or specific drugs that we can make that allow the blood vessels not to respond to inflammation as they would normally do and cause leak, but prevent that from happening and thereby reduce the sort of side effects of inflammation. We are designing things that could potentially be drugs. So this is at a very early stage. But the central issue why it's sort of promising from the pharmaceutical sort of situation or the biotech industry is the central way that people have tried it to affect change in inflammation is to block the whole inflammatory system. And that has many side effects. And what it is that what we're suggesting is there may be a way to design molecules, proteins, such that you can reduce the side effects of inflammation. And by understanding the basic biology, we have begun to find out what those targets are. And at the level of an academic laboratory, which is a very different level than a biotech or pharmaceutical company, we have promising candidates that one could think about how one would make a drug.
Dr. Lee is also co-founder of the pharmaceutical company Hydra Biosciences, and thus knows what it takes to make it in the business.
There are drugs that have been on the market, and it has taken $1 billion to get them on the market, and 5 bad publicized episodes, regardless of your statistics, will get that drug taken off immediately. And so a drug that makes it on has to be as perfect as it can go through in drug development. And even then, you're not guaranteed. So in many ways, I view this as, and it's very hard to predict what will kill a drug and what will make a drug happen. I think lots of people in the industry might not like that characterization, but I think it's really hard to predict what your winner and what your loser is until you do the experiment. And the experiment is to drive this as far as you can. But even something that has the perfect profile in all the studies you could ever do, and putting it on market, it's still, I would say, less than 10%, probably 5% of the chance of all the things that look perfect in development actually make it on. But the way to think about it is, it's many ways evolution in process. You have all these wonderful ideas coming up, and a priori, you can't pick out which technology is going to win. And essentially, it's Darwinning. There are people who are placing bets that, oh, we can be smarter in the way that we cripple the immune system, right? And maybe that's what will solve the problem that we're dealing with. And lots of people have different sort of ideas that they're passionate about, that they have proof of. But the bottom line is you have to prove it, and you have to be willing to advance it. And most of these things will fail. But if people aren't willing to take that risk, you'll get nothing. And so what you need is you need people who are passionate and believe it almost out of the realm of rationality. Does that make any sense? And just drive it.
It is a field which not too many people can play. And, of course, it does restrict number of drugs that can get on the market.
Dr. Dinesh Patel was born and raised in Zambia, Africa. After earning his degrees in pharmacology, he went on to head several biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies. One of these is called Theratech. Dr. Patel sold it to Watson Pharmaceuticals for $350 million. In 2006, he was inducted into the Utah Technology Council Hall of Fame, among numerous other awards.
It's highly capital intensive. Even to prove that you have a drug that works, you probably need $50 million or so. So it is not a garage industry, if you will.
Does it take a lot of patience to do this?
Well, you know, our cycle is we invest the first 3 to 5 years and then try to get our money back in the year 5 to year 10. So, yes, it is a long-term game, but, of course, it's rewarding if you have some huge successes.
Genetics is continuing to play a major role in drug therapy. Dr. Patel explains how the American culture has fostered this kind of work.
An interesting example would be warfarin, which is an old drug, a blood-thinning drug. And they recently discovered a gene that people that have that specific gene would in fact have a severe adverse effect. So now they're testing them before they give them warfarin. So again, using genetic information to make sure that you get the right kind of drugs. You know, there are very few countries that spend the kind of money that the U.S. spends on basic science. And that's where a lot of the discoveries eventually will happen. You know, people are smart people everywhere, but again, the entrepreneurship, the freedom to do things. There are very few places like U.S.
Dr. Ted Stanley.
One of the reasons it is more difficult for other countries to do it is that in almost all, but in in many of the other countries in the world, drug prices are controlled. So after you get the drug in most of the European countries, once you get it approved, then you negotiate the price. It's a fixed price. And it's almost always a lower price than in the U.S. But none of these countries develop new drugs. They take the drugs that we develop. So very few of these countries are leading or even having any pharmaceutical companies. And every pharmaceutical company wants to get in the United States because there's the chance of getting a better return on your investment. And it's been a good industry because it has allowed the rest of the world to enjoy the good health that it has, the improvement in medical care, and then as a result, longer lives, healthier lives. That has been a result of that. And if our society says, we're not going to have that, well, you're going to stop development in this, and you're not going to have the benefits that the pharmaceutical industry has brought to public health. And our society has to decide that if they want to do that, they can do that. But that's going to be the impact.
I will say about the experience of starting a pharmaceutical company is that what Mark Twain said is that all you need is ignorance and confidence, and then success is sure.
Tom Parks, Vice President for Research at the University of Utah, started a pharmaceutical company with his colleague Hunter Jackson in 1986. Although he is no longer in the business, he is an acute observer and acknowledges the downsides of the industry.
And I think maybe they can be faulted for overly aggressive marketing of products to patients who don't necessarily need them. And I think Vioxx is a case of that, where it was probably a very good drug for a subset of patients that really could benefit from it, would benefit more than they would be at risk from the side effects, but it was marketed more broadly to patients where the risk probably outweighed the benefits.
Rofecoxib was a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug marketed under the brand Vioxx, used for treatment of arthritis, painful menstrual cycles, migraine attacks, and acute pain. The drug was approved by the FDA in May of 1999 and was recalled in 2004 for safety concerns. Rofecoxib gained widespread acceptance among doctors prescribing the drug. At one time, over 80 million people had a prescription. In the year prior to withdrawal, Merck earned $2.5 billion in sales revenue from Vioxx. Merck voluntarily withdrew the drug after an independent data safety monitoring board found an increased risk in heart attack and stroke among patients taking high doses over a long-term period. In the 5 years the drug was in the market, the FDA estimates it caused at least 88,000 heart attacks.
They have to make profit. They don't always direct their efforts at finding cures for diseases that affect poor people. That isn't really their job in a sense, but I think a lot of people think that it is. I think they have been very aggressive in buying the friendship of physicians, which can sometimes constitute a conflict of interest for the physicians. So I would say to me those are the negative things. On the plus side, I think it's good to remember that there isn't any other kind of organization that develops novel medicines. There's actually relatively few countries in the world that can support the very complex organizations that are necessary to develop drugs that meet modern safety and efficacy standards. And if you were to kill off the pharmaceutical industry, I don't think that you'd find that there's any other organizations that can develop new therapies. So when people get, mad, I mean, it was the drug companies that developed therapies for HIV. It wasn't the government. People often say that the government does all the research, but in fact, 99% of the money that goes into the development of a new drug occurs on the private side. So I always ask people to balance their unhappiness with the drug industry with the realization that the alternative is no new drugs.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. I'm Sherry Quinn.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.